century, we had some Islam culture, in terms of civilization, and at the time they were very advanced in science and mathematics. So it was considered the most advanced society at the time. And since cryptography was quite widely used for matters of state, lots of scientists, mathematicians, researchers took an interest in cryptography, both in making the code better and breaking the code. So even back then, they found that security is not only one discipline, but if they mixed different disciplines together, they could find a way to very effectively break substitution cycles. But they mixed concepts of mathematics, statistics, and also linguistics to do this. So when they studied their religious text, the Quran, they noticed that some of the letters appeared much more often than others, right? And this holds for most languages, right? So in English, for example, the letter E and T are quite often, but we never use really Z or X or Q, right? And they referred to this process as frequency analysis. So if you did statistical analysis of the letters, you can find patterns and behavior that allows you to extract messages from substitution cycles, right? So, for example, so this is the average letter frequencies in the English language, from A to Z. You'll see that E, almost 13% of letters are E, 9% of letters are T, as opposed to Q and X and Z that almost never appear. So this is not a hard rule. So this does not mean that E will always be the most or Z will always be the least in a sentence or a passage or whatever. But this is a general rule, right? The interesting thing they then linked to substitution cipher is, you have to remember that it's a letter-to-letter mapping. So if we have a substitution alphabet and the E maps to a R, for example, if the E is the most common letter in the plaintext, R will also be the most common letter in the ciphertext. So in other words, if I look at the ciphertext and there's a lot of R's, then I must think maybe this R is most likely to be an E, or maybe a T, or maybe an A, right? And if there's some ciphertext letters that occur maybe only once in a very long sequence of message, then maybe we can think, well, that could be a Q, or an X, or a Z. So the main weakness that they identified was that the substitution cipher does not break up the pattern of the underlying plaintext. If you have patterns and statistical behavior in the plaintext, the same statistical behavior and patterns will occur in the ciphertext, just for different letters. Right. In addition, many languages, so we'll look at English specifically, have other things. So in English, the most common double letters are S, E, T, F, L, M, O, right? There are two single letter words, which is A or I, and there's also lots of other two letter combinations of two, it is B, as, have, so, we, E, I, or, on, or, do, in that order of relevance. So of is the most common one, S is the most common one, do is the least common one, who is the least common one, right? Then there are some three-letter words. There's only two three-letter words. They're commonly D and add. No, not only three-letter words, but like the most common three-letter words is D and add. And then there's some other funny things. So in the English language, if we have an E, the letter H very often goes before that E, but it will never go after an E. So if you can manage to find out which one is the E, if there is then a ciphertext letter that often goes before that plaintext E, then you can have a good guess that that is probably H. Right. Another thing that could happen is if you know some of the plaintext information, if some of the message that got sent, you already know, right? It might be that every single morning this person sends a message and starts it with good morning, or in the evening, good evening, or at the end says bye-bye, or something. then you know that a couple of the, you already know a little bit of the message, and that means you can pretty much recover the plaintext letters for that little bit of the message that you know. So that little bit of word that you know is called a crib, right? So let's look at an example. So if we have this ciphertext, then we cannot obviously see what it is. Alright, and we cannot brute force search it because we know it's going to take us a very long time. But we can use frequency analysis. Alright, so if you quickly look at this message, do you see any particular ciphertext letter that appears quite often? Alright, so one should come out as one that appears quite often, and that is the letter K. Alright? So if we use our frequency analysis and we say that, okay, well, the most common letter in the English alphabet is E, and we make a guess and we can say, okay, the K might be an E, we can map E to K. We also see that there is a single letter word here, so we know that that should be an I or an A, so maybe we can try it as an A, right? And now we can basically do the substitution. So now we can start, okay, there's some A's around, and there are some E's around. Right. Next step. Somewhere along the line, you see that the ciphertext letter N appears commonly before E. So what do you think the N is? H, right? Because we said H had this funny pattern where it's often before E, but it's not really after, right? So the N becomes H, right? So now we're starting to see some words, right? Now we see some up here. So what is the most common word that we're going to start a message with? L, right? We're going to say hello. So we can say that R is a R, and then this is commonly a hello. So now we have number of letters already. Right, and we have some partial letters. So now we can, for example, take this one here, right, and we can map it out. So now it's like doing crossword puzzle, right, and it's sort of, you have some of the letters, but you're trying to figure out what the rest of the letters are. So in this case, what do you think the word is? Example, right, because we are doing example, actually written up here. So it's example. Right, so it's example, so we can map it out, right? And now, what do you notice about the letters down here? What is interesting about them? They're in alphabetical order, right? So even if you only have partial of them, they're all in alphabetical order. So R, S, U, B. So we are probably dealing with shift cipher, right? And now we have enough information to know what the shift is. The shift is 6, right? And we can have our alphabet and we can decrypt the message. Right? So now you see how easy it is. So we could either give it to a computer or a huge server room and wait 4,000 years, or we can use this very simple method and just do it out here. Okay? Different methods, different resistance to different kinds of attacks. Right, so frequency analysis against substitution cipher are very powerful. So now you also know that the key is 6, and you can basically decrypt any message that you want going between Alice and Bob in this particular instance. Right. So I think I'll also put on Canvas, but if you really want to try this, just for fun, you can try and decrypt this message. And if you manage to do it, you can send me email, and I will tell you if it's correct. Okay. It won't get great for it, but just for fun. If you think this particular thing is fun, you can try and decrypt this one. And see if you can do it. You can do it in about half an hour, I think. Just use the frequency analysis. Okay. So how do we beat frequency analysis? Remember we said that this is like always been like this. I try to protect things, people hack it, I try and make it better. So people said, okay, frequency analysis, simple substitution cipher, it's pretty powerful. So what can we do to try and fix it? So people said, okay, we can omit the spaces. Like spaces makes it easy to see where words is. We can deliberately misspell some words. We can put in some random characters that are not in the alphabet or doesn't have meaning. We can also use codes. So codes have turned it almost into a two-iteration cipher. First, we'll go through the sentence. We we'll substitute code words for real words, or real words for code words, and then we'll do the substitution. Right? So each time it made it a little bit more difficult to do the frequency analysis, but the moment people figured out what was going on, people would basically just adapt frequency analysis to solve the problem. So generally people were looking for a better way of doing substitution ciphers. Right? So that's led to the next big advance in cryptography, which was using more than one alphabet to encrypt the same message. So in other words, having a polyalphabetic substitution. Right. So around this time, or around the 16th century, Vanier came up with his cipher. Okay? So Vanier was a polyalphabetic cipher. So that meant that he broke a lot of the pattern that happened with conventional substitution ciphers. So the way the Vanier cipher worked was you could have the same plaintext letter mapping to different ciphertext letters, and you could even have a single ciphertext that, a single letter mapping to multiple ones, and you can have multiple ones mapping to the same one. Right. So now you basically break up the pattern. Okay. So he uses multiple alphabets. However, the alphabets must still be chosen in some systematic way. Otherwise, this doesn't work. So how did the Vanier cipher work? So the first thing you did with the Vanier cipher, you chose your key. Right? So also, in this case, the alphabets was not the key, but it was the substitution cipher. You chose a key value, which is most likely a word, combination of letters. So in this example, we have five alphabets, and our keyword is Pauli, right? And what happens is now we'll have five alphabets, and each one of the alphabets will start with the corresponding letter of our keyword. So we have our plain text alphabet, A through Z. Our first ciphertext alphabet starts with a P. So the A is a P, and then we have the alphabet. The second one starts with an A, third one starts with a U, fourth one starts with an L, last one starts right. So how do we do encryption? So we want to encrypt the message hello, right? And we're going to use basically separate alphabets to encrypt each single one. So we're going to use the first alphabet to encrypt H, second one L, third one L, fourth one L, fifth one O. Okay? So if the message was larger, we have five alphabets. If the message was larger, then we'll just start repeating using up the alphabets. Right? Then we just extend the code word and the corresponding alphabet for longer. So we have hello seems to, is the same length as our keyword, so we can use every single alphabet once. If we wanted to extend it to hello Bob, we'll start using P and O and L and U again. Sorry. Right. So encrypting, the first one would be using alphabet P, and we're encrypting the H. So we will have a W. Then for the E, we're going to use the A alphabet, so we're going to get an E. For the L, the first L, we're going to have the alphabet U, so that maps to an F. Then we're going to have the second L, we're going to use the L alphabet, it's going to be a W, and the I is going to give us a W. So now you see we have encrypted hello to W, E, F, W, and W. So immediately you can see, well, that pattern that we had in hello before, that we had in our example, doesn't exist anymore. Because the first L maps to an F, the second L maps to a W. We also see that we have three W's in the ciphertext, and then we have three different plaintext values, H, L, and O, basically mapping to that W. So you can see that this is quite effective at breaking up statistical properties of the plaintext with relation to the ciphertext. Right. So, important things is we enciphered the two digits L to F and W, and we've enciphered H, L, and O all to W. So now you are dealing with simple letter frequency with patterns in the English language. It's going to be very difficult because your ciphertext is now very effectively distorted with regards to the underlying plaintext. Right. So Veneer, you can see, is slightly more complicated because now you have to deal with multiple alphabets. In a way, the key sharing is quite easy because you have code word rather than sharing an entire alphabet, right? And it takes some time to encrypt and decrypt, but it's very much stronger than simple substitution, right? So how did they break this Veneer cipher in the end? So for a very long time, for almost 300 years, Veneer was seen as state-of-the-art crypto, right? The only weakness it had was if you could figure out what the length of the code word was. Because if you could figure out the length of the code word, you would know when the multiple alphabets repeated. And if you could figure out which characters was basically encrypted with the same alphabet, you could still apply frequency analysis, right? So in 1863, so for a long time they said it's quite difficult to choose the code word unless somebody leaked it to you or it was a real word or you had some other information. So the first person that found a universal way of doing this without knowledge of the keyword, what it could possibly be, was Kaczynski. So the Kaczynski method said that inherently, just on average, we are going to see repetitions in the ciphertext. The repetitions is going to come from the fact that we just so happen to be encrypting the same plain text with the same sequence of alphabet, right? So if we, for example, have the keyword ABCD, and we are trying to encrypt, crypto is short for cryptography, as we go through the alphabets, so this plain text was with A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D, we see that in the ciphertext, certain parts of the ciphertext repeats. Because it just so happens that here, this plain text value maps up to exactly the same alphabet used to encrypt it. So the repetition distance is 16, which means there's 16 space, 16 letters between the start of the first sequence and the second sentence. And therefore, we know that the size of the key must be a divisor of that 16. So it could be 16, it could be 8, it could be 4, it could be 2, or it could be 1. In reality, there's going to be multiple repetitions, right? So if we have multiple repetitions, like in the bottom example here, the distance between the first VHVS and the second VHVS is 18. So we know that the length of the code word is 89.63201. And the distances between the first QUCE and the second QUCC is 30. So we know it's 30, 15, 10, 6, 5, 3, 2, 1. And if we look for the union or the intersection between these, then the key size is most likely 6, 3, 2, or 1. So this is probably too short. So you know that the key size is most probably 6. And once you know that the keyword is 6 and you're dealing with 6 alphabets, then you can essentially go back to using original frequency analysis to solve the problem. Okay. So after Veneer was broken, Veneer ciphers still lived on for almost 80 years. Right? So the last very, very famous version of what we can think is of as a real body alphabetic cipher was the Enigma machine. Right? Has anyone heard of Enigma machine? Okay. So in the Second World War, Germany was one participant in that war, and they encrypted all their communication using this Enigma machine. So the Enigma was a polyalphabetic substitution. And it basically involved both sides of the communication having the same machine set up in the same state. So essentially it looked like a very big old typewriter. I don't know if you've ever seen a typewriter. But basically, this one is opened up, so you can see the rotors and you can see some little lamps there. And on the cover it would have the alphabet printed. And if you wanted to encode a message, you would turn these rotors, you would set up some permutation on the front, swapping some letters around with a cable, and then you would type your message. So let's say you wanted to press the A, you would press the A, and the letter it would map to would be lit up by the little lamp. And it will show you the cover which way it's supposed to map to. Okay? started this work, you needed an instruction book that went with it, and the instruction book had a code. So that code could have been a monthly code or a weekly code or a daily code. And it said that if you want to send a message on the 10th of September, you need to configure your machine in this way. Right, so configuring the machine, as I said, on the front was a plug board with cables. So if you wanted to swap between A and L, you connected with a wire the value A and the value L, so that would swap around. And at the same time, you had rotors at the top that you could turn, and they had to be set to specific values. And these machines came in various versions. So if I remember correctly, the Army one was quite simple, so it had three rotors, whereas the Navy ones that was meant for boat or submarine U-boat that I had to go out for a long time had the more secure five rotor one. And each one of these letters had to be set the same. And then I would set mine exactly the same as the recipient. Both of us would look at the book, look at the date, set it exactly the same, and we will be able to send data to each other. Okay? So this is just showing what the plug board looked at the front. So it just had a wire with sort of like with a stick that you stuck in, and you could swap your letters around, and then these were the rotors at the top. So you turn them to a specific configuration body. Right. So the Enigma machine had approximately 2 to the 63 different permutations, right? Many different states. And the Allied forces spend a lot of time trying to do cryptanalysis on this machine. Okay? If you have opportunity to travel to the UK one day and you really like history, you can still visit a place called Bletchley Park. So Bletchley Park is where everybody went to work specifically on Enigma machines. Right? They try to get all the smart people in mathematics, in computing at the time, together there to all work on decoding Enigma messages. Right? So they were working on ways to reverse engineer the cipher. And if they could figure out the cipher, to figure out what the message was. Right. They even built these special things called Bombay machines, which were essentially little computers that could emulate Enigma machines. So each one of these machines could simultaneously emulate 56 Enigma machines. So they could configure it in different configurations and check or try brute force search for what specific configuration the Enigma machine had on that day, so they could get the message back. Right? So some of the cryptanalysis they did was aided by very good mathematics, very good computer science. A lot of modern computer science has its origins in Bletchley Park. The man that was most famous working there was Alan Turing. He's considered like the father of computer science. And it drove a lot of things into how to build efficient machines, coming up with the first computer system a couple of years later. A lot of that came from all the effort that went into this reverse engineering the Enigma machine. So despite all of this very fancy stuff, some of the reasons it made easier was that the machine and the people using it had certain operational deficiencies. So one funny thing about the machine was that the same letter could never encrypt to the same letter. So if you press the A, it would never re-encrypt to an A. So that meant you could already reduce one of the possible alphabets. The other one was that often the people operating the machine would be too lazy to update the code. So then their friend would just decide, well, it's too much effort to update the code every day, so we're just going to use the same code for like 6 months instead of 1 month. We're going to use it for 14 days instead of 1 month. And the other thing was crypts. So we spoke earlier about crypts, right? Crypts were known plain text messages that we know occur somewhere in the message. So very often these messages were sort of quite simple. Maybe it's a weather report, so it would just say it is sunny today. We can also see where the message was sent from was sunny today. So then we can guess, okay, the message probably says something about it being sunny. A lot of the time they had an operational rule that said you have to send the message even if there's nothing. So the message said nothing to report, right, in German. But that meant every single day you saw exactly the same message that said nothing to report, nothing has happened. So they already knew in some cases what the plaintext was, and that helped them. Right. So this takes us up into the 1940s. Right? Enigma machine, very famous last substitution cipher. Then we had a huge departure. So up to now, since Roman times, everybody was looking at substitution ciphers. We wanted to send text messages. We were stuck with the Roman alphabet. Everybody that worked on crypto was both sort of caught inside this box. Okay, we want to send text messages. We want to have a substitution cipher. The secret in having a good cipher is having lots of different permutations of text, polyalphabetic, breaking up frequency analysis. So in the 1940s, things changed a little bit. Right? So suddenly, people started thinking, hey, now we have radio communication. People started thinking about how to encode data. Is text really the best way to encode data? What happens to the rest of the world that doesn't use the Roman alphabet? Right? How would they send messages? We're going to start representing things with binary data, right? Especially if we want to send it radio, right? And now, how does this work for all substitution type ciphers? We need something significantly different, right? At the time, as we were working with now digital, the emergence of digital communication, radio, telephone earlier, was still Morse code, still text-based, right? People started studying information theory, right? And the biggest name in information theory at the time was a man called George Shannon. And he got interested in encryption and secrecy and confidentiality. And he went at the problem from a theoretical perspective of, if I could build the perfect encryption algorithm, what would that look like? So he said an encryption algorithm should provide us with what he termed to be perfect secrecy. So the definition of perfect secrecy is, even if the attacker had infinite resource and infinite time, he would not be able to break the cipher. In other words, even if he's able to brute force all the keys, all the combinations, essentially the attacker should not have any additional information at all about what the plaintext possibly could be. Right. And Shannon's solution for this was called the one-time path. The one-time path, as we look at it, is quite a simple concept. We're going to make plain text. Our plain text is going to be binary. So now we've moved away from having alphabet to having a binary value. So our message is assumed to be binary, 0 to 1. We are going to generate a key that is the same length as the plain text. And we are going to do a binary operation called an XOR on it to get our ciphertext. So for those of you that have not heard of exclusive OR or XOR, so XOR is a binary operation to combine single bits together. So you can almost think of an XOR as a difference function. So if the two binary values are the same, the answer is 0. And if they are different, they are 1. So if you go 1 XOR 1, it's a 0. 0 XOR 0 is a 0. 1 XOR 0 is a 1. And 0 XOR 1. So the two things are different, it's 1. If they are the same, it's 0. So therefore, we can have our plain text. We can have Hello Alice. We can convert it to a binary value. So these are basically ASCII codes, so the hexadecimal representation of each letter. We can make a random key, which is also a binary value. So here we don't write the binary because it will take us very long, so we write the hexadecimal version. And we XOR it together, and we get the ciphertext. So this is essentially what we want to do. Okay. Then, to decrypt, we just do exactly the same thing. We take the ciphertext, we XOR it to the key, and that gives us the plain text back. Okay, so why does that work? So an XOR function has another special property, which comes from the fact that it's a different function. If I XOR the same thing with itself, we're going to end up with a 0, right? Because everything is going to be the same. So every single resultant bit will be a 0. And if I XOR something to a 0, it just stays the same. Because a 0 and a 0 is a 0, and a 1 and a 0 is a 1. So what essentially happens here is we have plaintext XOR with the key, which is the ciphertext. We do ciphertext XOR the key. It's the same as saying plaintext XOR key, because that's the ciphertext bit. All XOR to the key. So we get key XOR to key, which makes it 0. Plaintext XOR to 0 gives us the plaintext back. So XOR is commonly used in cryptography for this reason, because it has a good way to go from ciphertext to plaintext and reverse the ciphertext to plaintext again. Right. The only problem with this was Shannon said to be truly secure, the pad, the key value, should be truly random and it must be used only once. And in practice, this is quite hard, but we'll get back to that. So, why is this good? Why was runtime pair design good? In this case, we have the same ciphertext we sent earlier, right? This was our ciphertext that mapped to Hello Alice. I could try a different key value, but I get a totally different message. But the different message also makes sense. So instead of saying Hello Alice, it now says Bye Bye Josh. Okay, so we have the same ciphertext. Somebody tried to decrypt it using another key. They got a different plaintext, and that different plaintext always makes sense. And this is what makes the one-time pad strong, and what Shannon thought gave it perfect secrecy. If an attacker would come along and decrypt the message, and the attacker is so powerful that they could brute force search all possible key values, then the attacker will also find all possible answers. And if the attacker finds all the possible answers, the attacker has no idea which answer is the correct one. Right? Because he's going to have every single key. One of the answers he's find is going to be the correct one. But how does he know that is the correct one? Doesn't know, right? It can be equally likely as any of the other messages that the attacker finds. So in other words, it gives us perfect secrecy. It's actually the only cryptographic mechanism in terms of encryption that gives us theoretical security or perfect secrecy. One-time pad cannot be hacked. Right? Unfortunately for us, it's also completely impractical to use. Okay? We mentioned on the previous slide that for it to work properly, every single time we need a key the same length as the message, and every single time this key has to be completely new and random. Okay? If we think about practically sending information, that is basically impossible. I'm trying to securely send you a message. I make a new key that's completely random, by the same length of the message, and now somehow I have to give you that key value. I have to give you that pad value. How do I do that? Right? If I had some tool that allowed me to give you secret things that are the same length as the message, I should just use that thing to send you the message. Right? That, it's simple as that. And the thing is, I don't have that tool. Right? So managing the key for one-time pad is impossible. So theoretically, this is very useful. It gives us a lot of useful knowledge and theory of how cryptography can work, but we cannot practically use one-time pad. The exception is if we use it in very specific instances, once again, almost for short text messages. So one-time pads were used during the 60s and 70s. There's evidence of spies using it because they could have a code book and their handler could have a code book. So similar to the Enigma machine, I basically had a book with me that said, today's one-time pad is, and then there would be a sequence. And then I would make myself a short message, I can XOR it to that one-time pad that's written in my book, I can write it on a piece of paper, hide it somewhere, the person I'm working with can come pick it up, they can then use their code book to XOR the one-time pad and get my message back. Right? But it was pretty much done by hand, and we already pre-distributed possible pads that we could use far in advance. And we can only really do that if the messages, once again, is very short. So in that instance, maybe it worked. Once again, it failed operationally. There were some people in the UK, they declassified things after 30 years or 40 years. they were talking about the Cold War with Russia. They said a lot of the messages they decrypted was, once again, people who were just too lazy. They were like, they have these code books, but they just had so much effort to look in the book every day. So they just kept using the same code word, like, day after day after day after day, to get some information out of that. But if you didn't do that, it would work quite well. Okay, so one-time pad, theoretically secure. From an information theory perspective, perfectly secure. From a usefulness perspective, not very useful. We cannot really use it. We can use some elements of it, but we cannot use it exactly. Okay. So coming back to what we had before. So we had Alice and Bob. We have symmetric encryption. We need Alice and Bob to have the same secret. Alice and Bob wants to use that secret to send message from Alice to Bob. Other person should not be able to get the key back. Other person should not be able to get it. Main takes that. Right. So, after the one-time pad, now we're getting into modern cipher. Right? Close to what you are using now. People, when they looked at the one-time pad, and said, some of these properties are really good. We like the binary data, we like the XOR, we like the idea that we're basically XORing the plain text to random looking bitstream. Right? But we know that it's not practical to use. So how can we take one-time pad and make it into something that is usable? So they came up with the idea of a stream cipher. So a stream cipher kept the model that we had before. We had Alice and Bob. Alice and Bob would have the same key, right? We then would have an algorithm. So we fed this key into an algorithm. And this algorithm would just produce us a random binary sequence, also called ciphering sequence or key stream. Okay? We would then generate key stream binary sequence of the same length as our plain text. We would take our plain text and we would XOR it to this, and this would give us our ciphertext. Bob would have the same key. Bob has the same algorithm. So when Bob feeds his key, when Bob basically initiates this algorithm with the same key, and it starts generating random bit stream, it's generating the same random binary value as Alice's, right? So Bob makes the same random value sequence. He XORs it to Alice's ciphertext, and he gets the plain text back. So we can see the similarities to one-time pad. Basically, we have random length binary sequence of same length as plain text. Then we XOR to the plain text to make a ciphertext. The recipient has the same key or the same pad, and the pad is XOR to the ciphertext to get the plain text. The only difference is that the pad is not truly random, but the pad basically comes from a pseudo-random number generator that's seeded or initiated with a secret key. So it's not truly random, but to somebody outside of it looks random. And this makes it practical to use, because Alice and Bob can both have this algorithm, and Alice and Bob, in a secure way, can exchange the key, because the key is short, right? The key doesn't have to be new for every single communication, or the key doesn't have to be the same length as the message, as the one-time pad should be required. So the stream cipher is basically one-time pad, adapted to be used in practice, right? So, stream cipher. So we have secret key, we have key stream generator, we have generate key stream or ciphering sequence or binary sequence. We have generate the same length as the plain text. We XOR the two together to get our cipher text. Right? And we can use the secret key length to be whatever we want. We have 128 bits, 256 bits, but it has to be short. Okay? The plain text can be of any length, because we can just keep generating key stream until we have a key stream that's equal in length to the plain text. Right. So one additional thing that's added to here, so we had just our basic model before, so if we see the ciphertext, we should not be able to recover the key on the plain text. So for stream cipher, it's the same. One additional little requirement is that if the attacker sees some key stream, the attacker should not be able to predict future key stream. Right? The moment an attacker is able to predict future key stream, what can happen? The attacker can then, if it knows the key stream that's going to be used in the next message, the attacker can encrypt his own message. Because he can make his own message, XOR it to that predicted key stream, and send it to Bob. Right? Or if Alice sends a message to Bob, the attacker would be able to decrypt that because he knows the next set of key stream that Alice is going to generate. Right, so one little additional thing. Right. So let's finish off by looking at an example of the stream cipher. So what I would say at this moment in time, so in this lecture, we look a little bit inside three different ciphers. RC4, PES, and AES. Right? In the case of AES and PES, especially AES, it becomes a little bit complex. Right? But we are going to do it anyway. The one thing I want you to remember is that I don't expect you to know the details of what happens in the cipher. I want to give some additional information to make you appreciate how these things work, what the thinking is behind the people that built it, and it also makes a good point when we compare symmetric encryption to asymmetric encryption. But I don't expect you to know every single small detail like every single cipher. Right? The level of detail I would, for example, expect you to know from midterm or exam is just a basic little description. What is the key length? What is the basic idea behind how it works? What's the block size? How much information we can encrypt? Not necessarily what is the number theory and the algebra that happens underneath inside AES. But I'll remind you of this again next week. The point in most of these cases that I think I would also like to make is that if we actually look at these things, obviously a lot of effort went into designing it, and I'll talk a little bit about that next week with AES. But if we actually look at how it's implemented or what the final design looks like, it's actually quite simple. Right? So it's based on very complex mathematics and combinatorics, but the end result looks quite easy. It seems like it's easy to implement. And as we saw last week when we spoke about standards, that's a good thing. If we can have a good solution that people want to use, they don't necessarily want to understand how it works, they just want to use it, making it simple for them to use makes it stronger. Because if we make it really, really complicated and they make a little mistake, then it's going to be broken. Right. So one of the more famous early stream ciphers. So stream ciphers are not that commonly used anymore. These days we use both drop ciphers that we're going to talk about this week. Originally, stream ciphers people thought were quite fast because you are just generating key stream. You're not actually decrypting information. But subsequently, things like AES is quite fast in itself. So you could rather, if you really want some properties of a stream cipher, just use the AES as the underlying key stream generator. But one of the early examples of stream cipher was RC4. It was invented by Ron Reves, and RC4 is basically the short for Ron's code version of it. So RC4 has two parts, an initialization part and a key stream generation part. And for some time, RC4 was considered a very secure cipher. Right? So this is from the early 80s. It's not considered secure anymore. Okay. So how did it do initialization, right? And once again, as I just said, if we go through the slide, the idea is not really to make you memorize this, but if you have done computer science and you have done some basic programming, you should recognize that this is actually very easy to code. As long as you have a little bit of information on what a for loop is and what an array is, you can implement RC4. You cannot design RC4, that would be very hard, but to implement it would be very easy, right? So you make three variables, the key, which is a byte array of size n, there's k, which is a byte array of size 256, there's the state variable, which is a byte array of 256, then you're going to do a for loop for initialization, so for i equal to 0 to 255, si, the the ith position in the S array is just going to be equal to I, and the ith value in A is going to be the key value corresponding to I modulo F. So we're just basically repetitively writing the key into the K variable. So key, several copies of the keys. Then we're going to go through a second set, and we're just going to shuffle things. Think about cards. We're just basically shuffling it, right? We're going to say J is equal to J plus SI plus KI modulo 256. And then we're going to swap SI value with SJ value, right? So we're just taking this state variable, and we are shuffling the values around. And that's it. So at the end of the initialization, we end up with a state variable, which is an array of length 256, and it contains basically a random permutation of the value 0 to 255 inside. Right? And then the second part is key stream generation, and this is even shorter. So remember, for a stream cipher, we want to generate the same amount of key stream as we have cipher text. Right? So if we have 80 bytes of plain text, we're going to generate 80 bytes of key stream. So how do we generate 1 byte of key stream? I is equal to I plus 1 modulo 256. So I is just going to increase from 0 to 255 and then jump back to 0 and go through. J is equal to J plus SI modulo 256. Swap SI and SJ. T is equal to SI plus SJ modulo 256. And your key stream byte is in the selected address. So basically, keep shuffling the state a little bit, and then we randomly select one of the state values to be our stream value, key stream value. And then we can generate enough key stream, we XOR it to the plain text to make our cipher text. Okay, so to end off with, where are we currently? So we have talked a little bit about the history of code making that led into crypto, lots of substitution cipher, lots of people adhere to substitution cipher and variations of that polyalphabetic up until less than 70 years ago. Then people started thinking about information theory, started going towards one-time pad, and one-time pad sort of set us on the path of thinking for what we do in modern day. So first people would adapt one-time pad directly to start making stream ciphers, right? And the second family of symmetric ciphers that we're going to look at, the modern ones, is block ciphers, which we'll look at next week. So essentially, inside the big world of crypto systems, we have symmetric crypto and public key crypto, or symmetric and asymmetric. Asymmetric is the other word for public key, right? And within symmetric key crypto systems, we have stream cipher and block cipher. So today, we dealt with symmetric key crypto systems and stream cipher, and next time we see each other, start looking at block cipher in this character. And we'll try and explain what the difference between block cipher and stream cipher is, and later we'll see what the difference between both symmetric encryption systems and asymmetric encryption systems are. Okay, so that is it for today. That would be finished. Remember that we still have the tutorials today, which we didn't have last week, so we'll have the tutorial questions, which are on Canvas, based on what we did last week. Just a reminder, because sometimes I see people taking pictures of the board. You don't actually have to do that because everything on Canvas, right? So all the notes, all the slides I give you, even the extra discussion I did today in the reading, all the solutions for the tutorials and everything is going to be on Canvas. So you're free to find it anytime there and read it whenever you want. If you want to take a picture, be happy. I'm not saying don't do it, but it's all going to be on Canvas anyway. Okay, thank you. I'll see you in the tutorial shortly. Thank you.